What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico is more than just a tropical paradise. It's an innovations paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, Puerto Rico has the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, this is the place to bring it. Find out more at investpr.org/economist.
The Economist.
Hello, and welcome to The Intelligence from The Economist. I'm Ora Ogunbiyi.
And I'm Jason Palmer. Every weekday, we provide a fresh perspective on the events shaping your world.
An uncomfortably large share of the internet's infrastructure is run by volunteers. It's a vulnerability that has existed since it was created. Why won't the rich tech companies just do something about it?
And bankers and accountants think about careers on an up or out basis. You rise through the ranks to this level in this amount of time, or you're out. But research suggests a more enlightened way to navigate. Move across sometimes, not just up. First up, though. In Brazil, something's popping up in troubling numbers that hasn't been seen since the COVID-19 pandemic. Emergency field hospitals. What's bringing people in droves to these open-air medical facilities is, again, a virus. Not COVID, but dengue, transmitted by mosquitoes.
Dengue fever will just put you on your back. It started with just this feeling of lethargy. I just didn't have any energy to get up and do anything.
Peter Granitz, one of our producers, learned several years ago that the symptoms can vary hugely. Many infections show none at all. Unluckier victims get something called breakbone fever.
I cannot describe to you how painful this was. Your joints ache, your muscles ache. This is not the flu. This is not strep throat. And I could not eat anything for days. And then I had a rash on my body. I could not take enough over-the-counter pain medicine to deal with the pain. I fancied myself kind of strong, kind of tough. I was completely wiped out and nothing was doing it.
The unluckiest patients develop hemorrhagic fever and die. It's estimated that globally, dengue takes at least 40,000 lives each year. Those field hospitals are a response to a staggering surge in cases. A couple decades ago, Latin America had about 500,000 cases annually. Last year, 4.5 million. So far this year, nearly 6. And it's still April. In Brazil, fumigation efforts have been hugely increased. But higher tech solutions are going to be needed, and more countries should get ready to fight this same battle.
Dengue case numbers are rising really sharply this year, but this is part of a broader trend. We seem to be breaking new records in terms of case numbers each year.
Kate Parker is a principal economist with our sister company, The Economist Intelligence Unit.
Latin America is finding it very difficult to do very much about it, partly because there's no particular treatment for the disease. To date, there hasn't been a very decent vaccine, and also climate change means that we're seeing lots more of these dengue-carrying mosquitoes around.
We started off talking about Brazil, but this sounds like a much bigger problem than just Brazil's.
Yes, that's right, Jason. It's spreading really fast in other countries as well. We're seeing lots of cases in Argentina, in Mexico, Central America, and the Caribbean. And that's particularly worrying because these countries don't normally see cases until later in the year. So I think the concern there is that this is just a precursor to a much worse wave in the summer. And also, interestingly, it's also showing up in countries that don't normally see the disease at all, like Uruguay and Chile. And that's very much related to the issue of climate and the fact that these countries are seeing more tropical weather where there are lots more mosquitoes circulating.
And just to put things into a kind of perspective here, we've talked certainly about other diseases on the show, like malaria, like COVID. When it comes to spreads, long-term impacts, how do these things compare?
Well, I think there are certain similarities. That was the first thing that struck me, really, seeing the field hospitals in Brasilia. you know, it looked just like COVID. And I think that fear too of catching something that's spreading really quickly, and the fact that, yes, you can protect yourself by wearing insect repellent, but as we all know from when we've used it, sometimes you just get bitten anyway. It's also similar to COVID in that people can come down with a really bad case of it, like we heard Peter describe. But also you get lots of people who don't get symptoms at all. And also, like COVID, you can catch dengue again. And that's because there are four strains of it. You can't catch the same strain again, but you can catch one of the others. And it's worth pointing out, some people do die from it. There's a severe form of the disease called dengue hemorrhagic fever. And if you've already had dengue before and you end up catching another strain of it, your risk of contracting this severe form is much higher.
And so what can governments do about this? What is the public health, the policy response?
Well, I think the difficulty is that governments really have very few short-term fixes available to them. As I mentioned, there hasn't previously been a very effective vaccine. One was rolled out back in 2015 called Dengvaxia, but it was subsequently found that it only works if a person has definitely had one of the dengue strains before. If they haven't, it actually makes them more vulnerable to catching severe dengue. So obviously, you know, that's far from ideal. It's not really used very much anymore. Now, the potentially good news is that there are several second-generation vaccines that have been in development in the last couple of years, and one from a Japanese firm looks promising. It's called Qdenga. It doesn't seem to have the same issues that Dengvaxia had, but the problem is that it's new, it's not being manufactured in particularly high quantities. And there's another vaccine also that's worth mentioning that's in the final phases of tests. But even if it all goes well, it won't be available until next year at the earliest. So I think the bottom line is that these vaccines won't do anything to curb the current epidemic. So in terms of addressing the outbreak, we've seen local governments resorting to fumigation by public health workers, these teams of people decked head to toe in white suits, spraying insecticide around. But I think the problem is that it's incredibly difficult to spray in every single nook and cranny where mosquitoes might be lurking. You kind of feel, looking at the pictures, they're fighting a losing battle, it seems. And you know, it's a very sort of low-tech way of tackling a rapidly spreading disease. There are also some more interesting higher-tech examples of dealing with the epidemic.
Such as?
Well, one thing they've been trying in parts of Asia is infecting mosquitoes with a bacteria called Wolbachia that essentially makes it much less likely that mosquitoes will transmit dengue. Essentially, this is done in a science lab, injecting Wolbachia into mosquito eggs. Then the mosquitoes are reared and then the modified adult mosquitoes are released into the local population. And essentially, the idea is that they start to outnumber dengue-spreading ones. It's been tested and rolled out in some places, including Singapore, to some success. Now, Singapore's case is quite interesting in terms of it is very much the gold standard in terms of how it deals with dengue, which is also endemic in that country. They're also very advanced in terms of using data analytics to track where dengue cases are cropping up, where mosquitoes are swarming, and they use all of this information to then spray insecticide preemptively. So the idea is that they detect these epidemics before they spiral out of control. So I think it's a very interesting and useful lesson for Latin America. I think the problem is that it's really very expensive to do that. Singapore spends a lot of money on its dengue control programs. And the bottom line, I think, is very much that Latin America lacks the kind of funds to replicate those programs that Singapore uses.
And you hinted earlier that the climate change is not only something to do with this, but something that might make this worse in the future.
Well, I think there are two trends that explain the surge in dengue. And the first is definitely climate. So these mosquitoes thrive in hot, humid climates. And what we've seen this past year is that more places in Latin America are seeing these sorts of tropical conditions. Warmer winters also play a role because temperatures aren't dropping so much. So these mosquitoes aren't necessarily being killed off over winter. I mentioned there are two trends. The other one is rising urbanization. So essentially the fact that there are lots more potential victims in densely populated areas like cities means that case numbers can rise really fast. And if you think about the nature of cities in Latin America, yes, you know, there are modern parts, but there's also a fair share of poorer areas, places where buildings have makeshift flat roofs, for example, where rainwater can pool. You know, some people don't have plumbing, so they store water in these huge open tanks outside. These are absolute breeding grounds for mosquitoes. I think overall, my concern is that even though there are some encouraging signs in terms of better vaccines, better public awareness of the disease, that this is completely outpaced by climate change and urbanization. And so that each year we'll see more areas affected, more people infected, and governments in Latin America really on the back foot in terms of dealing with it.
Thanks very much for your time, Kate.
Thank you, Jason.
Hi, this is Janice Torres from Yo Quiero Dinero. If you own or operate a business, whether it's a local operation or a global corporation, partnering with Bank of America could be your smartest move. By teaming with Bank of America, you'll enjoy exclusive digital tools, award-winning insights, and business solutions so powerful, you'll make every move matter. Position your business to capitalize on opportunity in a moment's notice. Visit bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness to learn more. What would you like the power to do? Bank of America N.A. Copyright 2024.
Some people spend most of their time online on TikTok. For others, Instagram is where it's at. Or any number of other sites and apps. But whatever your choice of platform, behind it all is the plumbing of the internet. Code that routes data and protects your sensitive information and financial details. The Economist Explains is a series of short, sharp articles answering questions about our world. Questions like, why is this vital software that runs our lives maintained by a community of enthusiastic volunteers?
The control and running of the internet's infrastructure has always been decentralized, basically since it was created decades ago.
Chris Stokel-Walker writes about technology for The Economist.
There's been a regular sort of uneasy truce between the state-backed enterprises that help bankroll the internet and the businesses that have capitalized on its success, and the academics and hobbyists who have tended to be involved in keeping the plumbing going. So although those hobbyists have a really vital role in keeping the internet online, it is an underlying challenge for them, and they can't always be relied on to keep it going constantly.
Let's take a step back a little bit. How are these hobbyists keeping the internet's plumbing going?
Every time that you click on a website, enter some text into a text box, if you're buying something, or even frankly, if you're just using an app, there's lots of stuff going on behind the scenes that is powered by software tools. That is often developed for free by those hobbyists who make the underlying code publicly available through what's called the open source community. And the idea behind that is if people can see this code, they can then look for any issues and maintain it. And if anything were to go wrong, or frankly, if hackers were to try and target it, then you want to try and stay one step ahead. So those open source volunteers, they're trying to keep it up to date. They're trying to keep it bug free. And most of all, they're trying to keep it secure.
Which you say a community of volunteers can't be relied on to do.
Absolutely not. These tools that are built by one or two people and maintained by potentially less than a dozen are keeping huge multi-billion dollar businesses online. The individuals who first created it didn't imagine that would be the case. And so suddenly the pressure gets much greater on them. Life also can get in the way. Maybe you started a project in your teenage years and you now have several kids and many, many other responsibilities. We know that there have been some people who have been responsible for maintaining these tools who have said this has negatively affected their mental health. And so the lack of upkeep on that can be a real danger to internet users.
In what way? What has gone wrong?
So Synopsys, which is a cybersecurity firm, analyzed software across 17 different industries. And they found that around about 3/4 of the code they reviewed was vulnerable to hackers or had been previously exploited. Now, I reported on a story 10 years ago for another publication of a flaw in OpenSSL, which is an encryption software company used to keep huge amounts of the internet secure, basically your passwords or your purchases whenever you go onto a website. Problem was, it didn't work. There was this vulnerability called Heartbleed.
A new online security bug dubbed Heartbleed had top websites like Yahoo, Facebook, and Google scrambling to make their sites secure. Usernames, passwords, credit card numbers, home addresses, phone numbers, and all kinds of information could be stolen.
The underlying issue was that essentially the internet was being protected by two guys named Steve. They had admitted and they knew that there were some issues with this, but they'd got too big for them to maintain. So the software was really vulnerable to bad actors, and that was a warning shot almost a decade ago. But this has continued ever since. Just last month, we had XZUtils, which is a tool designed to compress and decompress data on the Linux operating system that keeps a lot of key things running, so power plant systems or air traffic control systems. Now, a volunteer, we learned, had managed to smuggle malware into the code that allowed hackers to then send nefarious commands that could, in fact, have caused some big issues.
Chris, if these issues have been going on for years, haven't there been any attempts to improve the maintenance and security of the internet's infrastructure?
There have, but they haven't always been hugely successful, Aurea, and that's a big problem. Around about 6 months after the Heartbleed issue a decade ago, I caught up with one of those two Steves, because in the initial reporting of that story, I'd ask him what he needed, and he said probably about $1 million to actually pay people full-time to maintain this code base. Now, he got that. He got big tech funding from the likes of Google and others to develop a more stringent, more full-time, more professionalized way of keeping this software secure. But the problem is the headlines go away, the focus is no longer on that issue. And so that funding, that interest can sometimes subside. In reality, it would be easier probably to actually build stuff from scratch. We're still relying on key bits of infrastructure that were perhaps first conceived of maybe 60 years ago to run key parts of the internet. But the issue is we've built so much on top of that. Internet infrastructure is way too deeply embedded to rebuild completely, and no commercial incentive exists for any one company to finance the complete overhaul of the internet. It's kind of just trundling along, and the wheels are almost falling off, but not quite. Now, there is some help on the horizon. The Open Source Security Foundation is a developer community that's trying to make the internet more secure. But the problem is, and they say this themselves, tech giants are more keen on building big, shiny skyscrapers.
So if the tech companies won't build better infrastructure, is there any hope for internet security to be improved?
If we know that big tech companies aren't really going to focus their attention on the plumbing because they're too focused on the skyscraper, then we can at least get them to pay for the staffing to ensure that the pipes are safe. But that does require some significant things to happen that don't currently. We need, for instance, tech companies to come together, and often they're in high competition with one another. It might mean that we need the governments involved to try and compel them to do so. We're seeing a lot of anti-tech regulation at the minute, and this might be one step towards that. But the problem is they need to also be consistent funding. We need to really pay attention to this all the time, rather than just when something goes wrong.
Chris, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
The conventional way to think about career success is one direction only, which is to move up. But actually, there is another type of career trajectory, to move sideways.
Andrew Palmer writes Bartleby, our column on the world of work.
If you move laterally in your career, you can earn more and be more successful later. And people don't tend to think in those terms when they encapsulate or envisage career success. And studies show that if you do move sideways, it can help organizations because it ups retention. It also helps employees themselves.
You say studies show. How do these studies show that?
So there are various ones. There's a study by Donald Sull of MIT and a bunch of his co-authors that basically looked at the factors that predict higher retention and benchmark it to pay, the assumption being that pay is something that people value and that is a lever that employers can pull. And they found that the chance to move sideways within a firm was 2.5 times more important than pay as a predictor of workers' willingness to stay at a firm. So that's just from the retention point of view. Then there's another paper which shows that lateral moves don't just benefit the organization, but that employees who've moved sideways were more likely to be promoted, more likely to enjoy higher wage growth later in their careers than employees who did not move sideways. So you can move up even if you move laterally. And then there are others that show that good management and lateral moves seem to go hand in hand. So there's a recent paper by Virginia Minnie of the Institute for Fiscal Studies, which is a think tank here in Britain, that looked at the arrival of successful bosses within teams and showed that people who were good at managing were associated with jumps in intra-company transfers. And some of those were up, but a lot of them were horizontal. And again, people who move sideways seem to do better in their careers later.
So the take home here is to keep the ambition under wraps a bit, and eventually your ambitions shall be fulfilled.
Yes, I think that's right. I guess it's a way of thinking about career paths slightly differently. So it's not a ladder, it's more sideways. And in the process of researching this, I was desperately searching for animals that move sideways. And it turns out there are very few. There are sidewinders, but the one I alighted on was a crab. So be more crab.
And keeping with that, though, for a lot of people, that's not going to be satisfying, scrabbling around, as it were, in the dirt.
Yes, but I think actually lateral moves, as you can tell from the research about retention, is satisfying for a number of reasons. So even if you're not career-minded, if you're not sort of plotting your way in this slightly meandering process to the top, moving sideways delivers benefits. So one is that it's a good way of learning new skills. Another is that you form contacts more naturally with other people in the organization rather than just sitting in one department and not moving. The other is that it's stimulating. So people like to stay in jobs when they are given what are known sometimes as just right tasks. So you're not being tested in a way that is completely beyond your capabilities, but you are being tested. And one of the reasons why people leave jobs is because they're doing the same thing, they know exactly how to do it, and they're bored out of their minds. And it turns out that people really, really, really don't like being bored, at least not for very long periods on end.
If, in fact, it's so clear that this is good both for employers and employees, it sounds like the sort of thing that could be, maybe should be, written into company policy here and there.
Yeah, I think it's the kind of thing where employers who are more forward-thinking have already realized this. And so large employers in particular have more freedom of maneuver here. There are just that many more opportunities that they can open up to their employees. So they have things which are often called internal talent marketplaces where you can see what else is going on in a firm, you can make those sideways moves. And some of those marketplaces, by the way, select on skill rather than experience. So they really are agnostic to where you've been in terms of the organization. Smaller employers will have more trouble doing this, just there isn't the same range of opportunities. But even for them, I think one of the issues is, can you change mindsets? So for managers, there is a tendency to hoard talent. If you've got a good person on your team, you want to keep them, and that's not necessarily good for them or for the organization. So that needs to change. And then for the employee, him or herself, there needs to be this change in vocabulary and mindset which says, I don't have to just move up. I can move to the side and it can pay off. So I don't know exactly what that language would be, but whereas we talk a lot about scaling ladders, climbing poles, moving on up, we need something a little more crab-like. So making a meteoric scuttle might be the way to think about your career going forward.
Right. Onward and overward. Andrew, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Jason.
That's all for this episode of The Intelligence. As always, you can let us know what you think of the show by reaching out at podcast@economist.com. And we'll see you back here tomorrow.
What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico is more than just a tropical paradise. It's an innovations paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual, Plus, Puerto Rico has the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, this is the place to bring it. Find out more at investpr.org/economist.